Hello and welcome to Citizen Kane Minute, the show that examines the greatest film of all time, 5 minutes at a time. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And joining me to discuss minutes 20 to 25 of Citizen Kane is podcaster Trey Hooks. Hi, Trey.
Hey, Rob. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. I'm happy to have you here on the show.
I'm glad to be here. It's my first time on Fire and Water.
Oh, wow. Okay. This is very exciting. So it was sort of funny that I was, of course, on your show last year. Why don't you tell me what your name of your podcast is?
Sure. It's 99 Years, 100 Films. It's a podcast that I co-host with Blaine Dowler. Every month we look at what the best film winner was for a given year.
Right. And I happened to be on the episode where we talked about How Green Was My Valley, which is, of course, the movie that beat Citizen Kane for Best Picture in 1941. So everything that we do together revolves around Citizen Kane in some way.
Yes.
So I'm still not over that, even though that happened a full 30 years before I was born. But I'm still bothered by it. I mean, How Green Was My Valley is a perfectly fine movie, but, you know, come on.
Yeah.
But anyway, thank you for being here. I really do appreciate it. Now, before we get to the minutes in question, as I said, it's minutes 20 through 25. I have to ask the standard intro questions of my guests. So, Trey, when did you first see Citizen Kane?
It probably would have had to have been the early 90s. I was a big fan of Kenneth Branagh, and I don't know if you've seen it, but he had a film that came out in 91 called Dead Again.
Yes, I saw that many times, actually.
And I didn't know it at the time because I had seen it first, but it lifts a lot from Citizen Kane. So I had seen, I guess it was a Siskel and Ebert bit about Dead Again, and that made me want to go see Citizen Kane.
That's great. That's wonderful. That's a great thing for one movie, a recent movie, to inspire a different movie. So what, would you just go to the video store and rent it, or was it on TV sometime?
It was on TV. I think I caught it on Turner Classic Movies in the early day of that network.
What was your initial impression of it?
Oh, I loved it. I watched Citizen Kane far more often than I watched Dead Again. I'll put it that way. and that's nothing against Dead Again.
No. Yeah. So, all right, I was going to ask you, I mean, do you watch it repeatedly? It sounds like you do. At least you go back to it every so often.
I do go back to it every so often. It's not necessarily an annual thing, but I recently started a Letterboxd viewing project, so I know that I've at least watched it last year.
Okay. Do you like it more the more you watch it? Do you feel like it's the same? I mean, has it sort of changed as you've gotten older?
It has changed a little bit as I've gotten older. I appreciate some of the performances more than I did in the past. I still love Joseph Cotten. He's probably my favorite performer from this.
Oh, yeah. He's marvelous. He's marvelous in this. He's marvelous in everything I ever saw him in. So all right. So take this question as seriously as you like. Do you think it's the greatest film of all time?
It's certainly up there. It is certainly up there. I would say that it's definitely in my top five films.
Okay. Now that you've said that, what are the other four movies? I'm dying to find out what those are.
You know, it changes any given
day. Sure.
Yep. But there are certain films that I just have particular touchstones with. I'm a big fan of the Jimmy Stewart movie Harvey. My favorite musical of all time is probably Man of La Mancha. Superman is in there. And this may be an odd one, but the Gene Wilder Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
I think a lot of people love the movie. I'm ashamed to say that of those four movies you just rattled off, I've only seen two of them. I won't say which two. You could probably guess one of them, considering I do a movie minute show about it. But yeah, I've only ever seen some of those movies. That's very interesting to me. Okay, all right, well, that's cool, man. My top. I have like a top 10 in my head, and it does sort of change as, I don't know if it changes daily, but it does change whenever you might ask me. You know, some movies I'm like, oh yeah, that, and then it doesn't hold up as well, or things like that. There's been some movies that I saw in the theater that I'm like, oh, that's immediately one of my all-time favorite movies, and then I don't see it again for a long time, and I go, ooh, that didn't age right, you know? And I don't mean that it's
right.
The movie itself didn't age, in that it's like, oh, I'm this thing doesn't work the way I remembered it working, that kind of thing. So, I mean, but yeah, Citizen Kane stays that way forever. You know, it's just always good. It was the minute I saw it, it was in my top five and it's just stayed there permanently. So yeah, it's great that it sort of has done that with you over time, and then you have other movies come and go, but Citizen Kane is sort of always forever. So, okay. So let's talk about minutes 20 to 25 of this film. It opens with Mr. Thatcher reading the contract to Mrs. Kane, and it's going to end with our introduction of Mr. Bernstein. So the last episode ended in the middle of the scene with Mrs. Kane and Mr. Kane and Mr. Thatcher and, of course, young Charlie Kane as she is signing the contract over and is going to give all of his her sons, not only his literal body, but his fortune over to Mr. Thatcher to run in a sort of trust. And we have the scene of the father talking about, he's just talking and talking and talking and no one is listening to him. Mr. Thatcher's ignoring him and Mrs. Kane is completely ignoring him. And she even says, stop all this nonsense. And in the meantime, we see young Kane playing off in the snow, having no idea what's about to happen to him. And I hit upon this in the previous episode, but it continues on here. It is amazing what Agnes Moorehead manages to do with her one scene. We see her earlier in the film in a still image, but this is her only scene in live action. And it's just remarkable what she's able to convey with just not a lot of dialogue, of just her quiet dignity of that clearly something is very, very wrong in the relationship with her father, with her husband and the father of her child, that she's willing to go to this length, which seems pretty extreme for her son, is to hand him over to this total stranger. It's an amazing performance.
It is. You get a sense that he's a drunk and that at the same time he loves his son. Maybe he's slightly abusive.
Slightly abusive.
And you can tell that she's motivated from a good place. She does not want her son to turn out like his father. She doesn't want him growing up in such a rough and tumble places, wherever it is they are in Colorado.
Yeah, yeah. She's making this extreme decision. And again, I mentioned in the previous episode, you have that masterful tracking shot coming in from the window all the way through the boarding house, literally through the table. And we see like the little hat is rocking because the table is a spring away table and it's been reset. So the camera can go through it. And this whole scene of Mary Kane sitting there ignoring her husband, talking to Mr. Thatcher. Mr. Thatcher, he sort of acknowledges the father where he has the line about you, he goes through the whole bit about the collar on the load and he says, which you are the sole owner. And he kind of hits on that soul. And he even throws a look at the father. It's kind of like, look, you're not part of this. We're sort of humoring you. And then they go through this whole scene and then they all stand up. And I kind of forget about this, even though I've seen this movie so many times, the tracking shot resumes. This is all one giant shot, is the camera pans back, goes through the table. Everybody sits down. They have all this dialogue. Then Mr. Kane walks back to the foreground. That's a weird sentence. Mary Kane stands up. Mr. Thatcher stands up. They head back to the window and the camera then follows them back to the window. So in the meantime, while they have stood up, presumably some of the stagehands have grabbed that spring away table, pulled it away, and now the camera can resume its tracking shot. And, it's amazing how many times I've seen this movie, but it never really occurred to me before that it is all just one giant shot. And they go through this scene with the overlapping dialogue, and it's absolutely pitch perfect. I would love to know how many takes it might have taken to get to this shot, because it's remarkable.
Oh, it's incredible.
So then we finally get a cut where we do a reverse on Mary Kane, and she's at the window, and we see the father in the background and Mr. Thatcher, and she barks at him, Charles, and she sounds a little bit like a martinet, but you got to realize, this is probably the most painful thing she's ever going to do in her life. And so she's probably kind of almost going on autopilot just to get through it, because she's going to hand over her son and presumably never see him again. We don't know that for a fact, but you got to guess that in this age, I mean, this is like, what, 1877 or something like that when this is taking place, that traveling by train was obviously a much bigger deal. And then we follow Thatcher and Mrs. Kane and Mr. Kane out, and we meet Buddy Swan. I talked about him in the previous episode. He looks, this actor, he looks remarkably like a young Orson Welles. They did a really great job of finding a guy that looks like Orson Welles.
And you mentioned she's probably never going to see him again. They may have been lying to him, but Thatcher to mollify him does mention, you know, your mother will come to visit. Now, you know, did she ever? Probably not, but they do kind of throw that little lie out there to Charlie.
Yeah, they're trying desperately. I mean, can you imagine being a small child and having this real, not only a stranger, but this incredibly officious, very serious guy come and say, you're going to come live with me? Like, what are you talking about? And so they have this whole conversation back and forth. And again, you can see the father in the background. And he's, again, desperately trying to be part of this conversation. But Mary Kane and Mr. Thatcher ignoring him. And then finally, young Charlie Kane walks up to him and they talk a little bit. And he's trying to talk. He's like, you're going to be rich, Charlie. And, they, you know, of course, to a kid, what does that mean? You know, I mean, a little kid doesn't care about that. Well, his needs are met. So what does it matter that he's going to be rich? And so that's the only – it says something about the way the father can't even really relate to the son, that's what he thinks is going to be the selling point.
Well, and it speaks volumes about their relationship that what – Charlie keeps focusing on is, why aren't you coming, Ma?
Yeah, right. That's all he wants to know about is why isn't his mother coming along? And Mr. Thatcher tries to get involved. And I love the look on little Charlie's face. He's got this squinty face. It's just like, what the? And you can just tell he knows he's being sold kind of a bill of goods. You know, he's not having any of this. And when he finds out that his mother's not coming with him, that's when things get bad. And then he picks up Mr. Thatcher tries to kind of reach out to him, and young Charlie Kane hits him with the sled and almost knocks Thatcher over. And again, I love how, like, what a stiff Thatcher is, where he's just like, he can't imagine that a young kid might react this way. And he's like, Charles, you almost hurt me. And he's just so, so serious. It's just such a stiff. And he's like, God, imagine wanting to go with this guy. And then, of course, he tries to run, and the father immediately turns, and he actually reaches out and tries to hit Charlie. Mm-hmm. He tries to hit him and he misses, but he tries to reach out and him. Of course, that's his first, you know, instinct. And he apologizes to Mr. Thatcher and he says, that boy deserves a good thrashing. And, you know, you're like, well, now we're seeing what the problem is. And then the camera pans in, and I love that Mary Kane challenges him. And he's like, is that what you think? And, you know, they lean into each other and she says, well, that's why he's going to go away where you can't get at him. And it features this marvelous close-up of Agnes Moorehead and Buddy Swan. And just, again, the resolution in her voice. And then we cut down to Charlie Kane looking about as angry as it can be. And I just – the film does so much with so little. I just feel that line, you just totally understand the situation, which is where you can't get at him. That she is she is so scared for her son that she is willing to never see him again, or at the very least remove him from her life to get him away from this father. That's how bad things are.
You know, you mentioned this earlier. I know that Agnes Moorehead is best known for her role in Bewitched.
Sure.
But if that's all you know her for, you really don't know Agnes Moorehead.
Oh, man, yeah. Oh, I mean, I, you know, when I was a kid, I was only familiar with her for Bewitched. I never knew that she was in Citizen Kane. She was part of the Mercury Theater. I didn't know any of that stuff. It's just remarkable.
I could not tell you which radio show it was, but she did essentially a one-woman or close to a one-woman production of Sorry, Wrong Number. That was just incredible. Yeah.
That's, geez, I'd like to hear that. That sounds marvelous. I love that movie. So that would be that would be really cool. I mentioned in the previous episode that Wells wanted to cast her in the Edward G. Robinson part in The Stranger, which meant she would have been the one tracking Orson Welles' Nazi in hiding down, which just completely would have thrown that movie off its axis in a good way. Because you just did not see things like that in 1946 movies of women being sort of the action protagonist, being a Nazi hunter. And as much as I like that movie, and I do, Edward G. Robinson's great in it. Boy, I would have loved to have seen the Earth 2 version where she was the kind of the lead. That would have been amazing.
Oh, yeah.
So then we have a shot of the sled. The sled as it's being laying in the snow, collecting dust. And of course, not dust, collecting snow. But of course, you know, we're seeing the sled here. And the next time we see the sled, it's going to go from being buried in snow to being basically engulfed in fire. So we're going to see the two ends of this sled's existence. It's sort of funny when you realize that the sled, as we all know, spoiler alert, makes its way into Charlie Kane's, you know, bric-a-brac, and it ends up getting burned. But yet that meant that this sled was stuck around all this time. Like, even though Charlie Kane got shipped off to go live with Thatcher, his parents kept this sled. Like, it didn't get thrown out, which is sort of remarkable. You know, you could imagine that you would probably at some point, even if you continue to see your son at a certain point, he grew up, you would think that they would just throw it out. But nevertheless, this sled must have been kept by the mother because it eventually makes its way into Xanadu.
And what a remarkable bit of editing. There is maybe a 1 second shot when Charlie pushes the sled up against Thatcher, mm-hmm. when you can barely make out what's on the front of the sled.
You know what? I didn't even see it. I mean, I knew what it was, but I couldn't make it out. So yeah, maybe if I had a 4K or something, I'd be able to make it out.
I think that they edited so well, you can't. Your brain fills it in if you're looking for it because you know. But first time, I don't think anybody would ever catch it.
Yeah, right. They don't tip it or anything like that. And, you know, when you go back and you watch the movie and you're like, oh, wow, the shot of the sled being left behind in the snow is very significant. But of course, when you first see it, it just feels like it's sort of a filler shot. You're like, okay, they're going from one scene to the next scene. And so then we find young Charlie getting a new sled for Christmas. And of course, it's not the sled that he wants. I love the way they dress him. He dresses like Little Lord Fauntleroy or something like that. He's in this little frippery. And I love just Buddy Swan. He looks miserable. It just looks – and, of course, we've got Mr. Thatcher saying, you know, Merry Christmas. And it's like – he looks like he's in the – he looks like he's in a production of Scrooge. You know, it's like the most joyless Christmas imaginable. And it's so funny to me that, like, I could see that Mr. Thatcher is the guy that manages young Charlie's money. But, like, is he his dad now? Like, why would Mr. Thatcher take that on?
It's like some Mirror World Daddy Warbucks stuff.
Yeah. It's just like, boy, I would not, you know, bad enough that this guy's looking after me. But, like, what, do you live in his house and stuff? Like, it just sounds terrible. And then we see a reverse shot of Buddy Kane in front of – excuse me, Buddy Kane. I'm combining Buddy Swan, a playing Charlie Kane, in front of the fire. And he raises the sled. And then we get one of the film's big flash forwards – where we see Mr. Thatcher say Merry Christmas, and then we cut to an old Thatcher featuring a made-up George Kalura saying, and a Happy New Year. And, you know, it's not entirely unprecedented, but nevertheless, this is a 1941 movie flashing forward about 20 years in 1 second. It's pretty remarkable.
And then we have that great scene of him starting to rattle off what Charles' holdings are now, because evidently he's now 25 – the trust is falling to him.
Yeah, he goes through. He's rattling off the things to some his secretary or something like that, and we're getting this establishing. Like, okay, we are now. I mean, again, I don't mean to keep like in sort of insulting 1941 audiences, like they couldn't understand these things, but I do wonder what a lot of moviegoers were thinking when Welles was sort of speaking to them using new movie grammar like this. That you have to sort of immediately, first of all, we forget, or maybe some of us do, it's easy to forget, that this is a giant flashback. This is not happening in sort of real time. This is all coming from Mr. Thompson reading Mr. Thatcher's book. So this is Mr. Thatcher telling the story of all this. I mean, so we're in a flashback. There's a flash forward inside of a flashback, which is where this is like Inception time here.
Well, and So this is the piece I love, because our 5 minutes doesn't end before Mr. Thompson stops reading. But we see the answer to what he's looking for. We don't know that we've seen the answer because he doesn't know about the answer being there, because we're seeing something visually that he's reading that wouldn't be in the text that he was reading.
Right. Yeah, right. It's again, this feels like by the virtue of the flash forward, this feels like it's an omniscient narrator But it, of course, it really isn't. This is Thatcher's view of this. Thatcher is telling the story that young Kane was a little bit of a snot and hit him with the sled and stuff like that. So we don't exactly know. I mean, you get the sense that's what's really happened, but we don't really know because this is Thatcher telling the story. And so, yeah, he's relating all of this information. And again, it's, he's catching the audience up on what's been happening in the time that this is going on. And so then we get another cut. And we see there the letters being written. We see that Charlie has written back to Mr. Thatcher. And I love this sort of like wonderfully like dyspeptic look that, that Thatcher has. He just is sitting there as he's reading this letter. He's just kind of like, And then we get, he says, I'm coming back. I'm coming back to America. Don't sell the Tribune or whatever it is. I think it would be fun to run a newspaper, which of course Thatcher is immediately does like the, George Koloris is great at like fumfering. He's great at that, like, oh,
yes,
blah, blah, blah. There's going to be another actor that's great at fumfering, too. But he does that thing, and he grabs the paper, and he puts his glasses on, and he recites it, and he does the whole classic, reads the line, I think it would be fun to run a newspaper. And we get even Mr. Thatcher looking directly into the camera, which is like what? This is supposed to be a drama, and yet it really – it works because again, it's his flashback. So it's like, he's not really looking into the camera. It's, this is just his emotional state. This is how he's remembering it.
We'll talk about it when we're done synopsizing, but he's one of the two reasons why this 5 minutes was like the top of my picks for the show.
So we get this montage of where we've got Mr. Thatcher reading the paper, and I love Bernard Herrmann's music here with that little like dee 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 dee, like it's, it almost sounds like alarm bells or something going off. It's
yep.
Great, this sort of up tempo music, and we see that Thatcher, who was of course, you know, for whatever version of this existed in the late 19th century, very conservative. He's very wealthy. He's not interested in fighting for the people. So we see that we're reading all, and he's reading the newspaper. It says Traction Trust exposed. And he's just, he's, and the Traction Trust bleeds, Traction Trust smashed by Inquirer, which I love these headlines, these sort of self-aggrandizing headlines. And it's this constant him throwing the paper down and getting frustrated. We just know that he's reading this every day. Landlords refuse to clear slums. And he's so frustrated. And I love all these are, there's this amazing shot, Inquirer wins slum fight. And there's this, it's this incredibly fake looking thing where he's in front of this building with what I'm guessing is supposed to be the moon behind him.
Yes.
Except the moon is like, it's like, it looks like a dirigible. It's so huge. It looks like something out of like Batman. It's so comic booky looking. Again, I love the way Wells gets away with these, this sort of mix of styles in this movie.
Well, and my headcanon is those are all holdings that the bank has.
Oh, interesting. Oh, okay. You mean the building he's in front of is something that the bank owns?
Well, not that, but when they're talking about the slum lords.
Oh, right.
The bank owns those tenements.
Right. Oh, sure. Sure. See, yeah. That's, yeah, yeah. He can't stand the fact that Charlie Kane is using his own fortune to go after him. Well, it says Wall Street backs copper swindle. 2 exclamation points. Again, we know we're getting to sense what kind of journalism that the Inquirer is practicing here. It's very, very excited. I love, again, we've even got, we get to Thatcher leaning into the frame from his chair and look again, looking right in the camera. And then we have him at breakfast. I love that we catch him while he's eating and we can hear him kind of talking while he's got food in his mouth. His copper robbers indicted. And I love that little doohickey that he's got that you're supposed to, that is, I guess, for, I don't know, these wealthy people, but I can't imagine it, but where it's like this little wire rim that you insert the paper into so it holds it up straight while you sit there and you can eat your breakfast. I love that little doohickey.
Yeah, it's almost like a music stand, but for like a newspaper.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And so then we get Galleons of Spain off Jersey Coast, which is the beginnings of the kind of, the beginnings of the Inquirer is going to be fomenting a war based on real life. What happened in real life, the Spanish-American War was sort of ginned up by newspapers. And so they're kind of hinting at that and where we're going. And we see Thatcher reading the paper. And now all of a sudden we see that we are in some sort of newsroom. And it's a great shot because, of course, we were about to see young Orson Welles or 25-year-old Orson Welles as he looked in 1941. But we don't see him in the frame. We just see Thatcher with the newspaper. And then he folds the paper angrily, and bang, we've got our first introduction of Orson Welles, again, as he looked in 1941, handsome devil, sipping a cup of tea as he is sitting there listening to Thatcher rail against him. So I mean, we'll wind back a little bit, Trey. We talked about Citizen Kane. How familiar were you with Orson Welles as you were growing up? Like, did you know that he was famous for Citizen Kane beforehand, or did you see him in things before that?
I knew he was famous for film in general, not necessarily Citizen Kane. I like to say that my dad was the generation before us as a version of a geek. He was really into The Shadow, so I knew Orson Welles was The Shadow. But, you know, apart from, you know, the standard rich and famous contract at the end of Muppet Movie and the and, you know, he did that Nostradamus documentary.
Yes.
I don't know that I had really seen him in anything else.
Okay. Yeah. I saw him in the Muppet Movie as well. I saw that in the theater. So I must have, that might have been the first time I ever saw Orson Welles when I come to think of it, probably in something. So, yeah. So, and by the way, not only do we get the great intro with the paper being folded, again, Bernard Herrmann's music, this theme, the little dee-dee-dee-dee-dee thing ends with this big cacophony of horns and drums coming in, kind of ba-da-ba-da-ba-dum, and then bang, we see Charles Kane sitting there, and he's got these black suspenders and a white dress shirt, and he just looks marvelous. I mean, he just looks great. And this is Orson loved to put on fake noses and hair pieces and beards and all sorts of big fat suits like he had in Touch of Evil. But here, this is one of the chances we're going to get to see him by himself, just looking very, very handsome and leading man-ish. And obviously, he's relaxed here at the paper. He's got his shirt open, and he's sitting there. And he's just – I love the smirk that he's got with Thatcher. I just love that he's kind of like not really taking Thatcher terribly seriously. Thatcher is furious. But here, he's just kind of looking like, oh, okay. And then we are going to get a very, very quick introduction to Mr. Bernstein. We're going to find out more about him in the next episode. But here, he leans in, and he starts talking to Charlie. And that's where the 25 minutes – and we're going to get a very, very, just a very brief introduction to Joseph Cotten. We see him in the background in kind of a blur, but we're going to learn more about him next episode. But the 25 minutes ends with Charlie Kane staring at Mr. Thatcher as they go through their pace.
Yeah, I like to think that Charles Foster Kane, as portrayed by Orson Welles, just oozing charisma here, is what's Stan Lee thought he was in his mind. And I don't say that to knock Stan Lee. I don't. I love the man's legacy. But just that pure force of will to do things his way.
Mm-hmm. Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, hey, you know, we all love to see ourselves, though. I mean, one of the reasons I love Orson Welles like I do is because I feel like he kind of carried himself with an air of confidence that I aspire to, that I know I will never have at this age. I think the cake is baked by now. But I admire Orson's just sort of confidence. Now, I'm sure creating the greatest movie of all time at 25 years old gives you a lot of confidence.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, you had to have confidence to get here. I mean, he had already had a great radio career in the War of the Worlds, and he'd been The Shadows you talked about. So, yeah, I appreciate that he's just got that kind of swagger to him. Which is very attractive. It's attractive in every sense of the word. It's like it's great for a leading man. It's great for your main character because he's got that kind of devil may care sort of attitude. It's sort of a Han Solo kind of thing. Like he knows he's great. So all right. So Trey, you said earlier like these 5 minutes were at the top of your list. What is it about these 5 minutes that you found so compelling?
Two things. One absurd and one serious. The absurd thing is. Much like Shag and Siskoid, I'm a Whovian, and rather facetiously, especially when Doctor Who kind of made its triumphant return, I used to tell people that one of the marks of a great movie was that it had a Doctor Who tie-in. Star Wars trilogy, all three of the first films, Doctor Who tie-ins. The Indiana Jones films, Doctor Who tie-ins. And George Kunduas played Arbitan on the Keys of Marinus in the very first season of Doctor Who.
Oh, wow.
So Doctor Who has a tie to the greatest movie ever made.
Very nice. Okay. All right. So what, I mean, what is it? What is it about this sequence as well, too, that you were so, that you just thought was so, so interesting?
Just that, and I apologize, I'm going to speak a little bit outside of the 5 minutes, but this is a film about a broken man who wants to be loved, who's forgotten probably what it's like to be loved and to be able to love. And what was on his mind was a remnant of his past when he died, which was the last time he felt that way. And this 5 minutes, you don't know it when you're seeing it, but this 5 minutes is when you are seeing that.
Right, right. I mean, this is the crux of his life. This is every, you know, this is the big moment where everything changes for him. And it's a thing that he is desperate trying to get back to, and he knows that he can't, because it's, I mean, obviously there's going to be a scene later on in the movie where we talk about that he was off to a warehouse to go look for something, which means he was going to look for the sled and he never gets around to it.
Right.
That's when he meets Susan Alexander. But this, that moment that we see in there is the seed that's going to plant it in his head, and his life will never be the same. And even though in this moment he's looking like he's having fun, I think it'll be fun to run a newspaper, and he's going to have some fun in his life. There's something in him broke, and it stayed broke for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
It's just, again, it's a marvelous, marvelous sequence. And Wells does so much in just 5 minutes. He tells so much story, aside from just the 20 years jumping forward. He's just setting up, okay, he inherited this newspaper through luck because of just all the holdings that this company has to own. And he's overseas, and he's kind of being a flibbertigibbet over there. And then he decides, oh, he looks through and he picks, oh, I'm going to run. And just the idea, it'll be fun to run a newspaper. Not that it's serious business or that it really is. Just be fun. And he decides, okay, this is what I'm going to do with my life. And we're setting up that he is a muckraker. You know, he's a troublemaker in any sense of the word. And he is willing to literally, not literally, of course, bite the hand that feeds him. And that it's all this money that is funding the newspaper, all these holdings that Thatcher has, and yet he's going after them. As you mentioned, he probably owns some of these hotels that he's very, you know, these slumlords he's going after are somewhere involved in. He probably gets money from those in some weird way, and yet he's willing to do it. And it's just, we're being set up as he's this great hero. We're going to find out again, as you say, he's a broken man. But for right now, he is being pitted against the dry, officious Thatcher. And again, it's a marvelous introduction to come in, finally see the Citizen Kane of the title.
Well, right now, he doesn't care. You know, if he lost everything, he would be as poor as he was when he was at his happiest. Now, later on, that becomes not true. But for where we leave him in this 5 minutes, I think he wouldn't care if he lost it all.
Yeah, probably not. Probably not. It's interesting that how come we don't see Kane between these ages. We never get to see, you know, 13-year-old Charlie Kane. And he obviously has become very comfortable with the money that he has because he's very confident with it now. I mean, and he went from being dirt poor to living in this one-room house, presumably, out in the Colorado wilderness, to now he's this sort of scion. And he's, again, he's got that swagger to him. And he's the boss of all these guys. And he's willing to risk some of the money that he's taking in because he's got so much of it. And of course, there'll be that great line later on in the next scene where if he loses $1 million a year, he'll have to close this place in 75 years or whatever it is.
Right.
And he's just got that enormous, enormous confidence. It's a great sequence where, again, right at the 25 mark is when we're finally meeting our hero, Orson Welles playing Citizen Kane. Again, it's just a marvelous introduction with the music, the scene setting, again, and all the characterizations. It's great. And very shortly, we're going to meet some of the other marvelous characters in this movie. So that's going to be it for the minutes 20 through 25 of Citizen Kane. Before we wrap up here, Trey, is there anything else you want to say about the movie in general?
Well, I don't know anyone who would be listening to this podcast who doesn't already love the movie. But if you're one of those strange souls, you know, maybe you thought this was Pod Dylan and you clicked on the wrong thing in the feed, go check out the movie. You will be so glad that you did.
Yes, I can absolutely endorse that point of view. Yes, don't let us sit here and ruin it for you for the next we go 5 minutes at a time. Go watch this movie and then you can come back and enjoy this. So, well, Trey, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it and it was fun talking to you.
It was fun talking to you as well, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Why don't you tell people where they can find you on the internet?
Sure. I am on Facebook just under Trey Hooks. As I mentioned at the top of the show, I co-host a podcast, 99 Years, 100 Films with Blaine Dowler. You can find that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Anchor FM, or the Bureau 42 website. I'm also on Letterboxd under Gotham Kid. If you want to check that out and follow me just to see what I happen to be watching this week.
So, well, you know what? Just as we're recording this, the Oscars were not that long ago. What did you think of that Best Picture winner, which in this case was Nomadland?
I honestly haven't seen it yet. It's in my Hulu queue, but I haven't watched it yet. I was rooting for Promising Young Woman.
Me too.
awesome episode you had on it on Film and Water, by the way. But
thank you.
I am one of the people that actually went, screw it, it's the pandemic. I'll go ahead and lay the $20 down to see it. and I'm glad I did. You know, it was a tough year for me in the Oscars this year. I had Daniel Kaluuya, who was in an episode of Doctor Who, win Best Supporting Actor, but Casey Mulligan, who was also in Doctor Who, missed out on Best Actress. But hey, Doctor Who tie-in, so Judah and the Black Messiah and Promising Young Woman both have to be pretty good movies.
Carrie Mulligan was in a Doctor Who? Really?
Yes, she was. She was in one of the one that I know that both Siskoid and Shag would wholeheartedly endorse, the episode called Blink.
Huh, okay. We're getting so far off Citizen Kane, but I'm fascinated. Was this when she was famous, or was it like early in her career?
Early in her career. We're talking roughly 2007, 2006.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Okay, I mean, virtually every British actor ended up being in Doctor Who.
Of course.
That makes sense. Okay, gotcha. All right, cool. Well, again, thank you so much for coming by. I really very much appreciate it. Of course, everybody, we're always talking Citizen Kane over on Twitter at CKaneMinute. You can find all the back episodes of the show on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Stitcher. And if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, you just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. There you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So if you're really enjoying Citizen Kane Minute, and I hope you are, go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. That's going to do it for now. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Come back next week for more Citizen Kane Minute.
What's the real truth about Charles Foster Kane? I wish you'd come to this theater when Citizen Kane plays here and decide for yourself.